I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The South Carolina primary marks the spot where the political tone of voice goes strange. It went venomous and personal among the Republicans, but then nervous and squirmy among Democrats, as two white Yankees make their play for black votes in the old Confederacy. The question this radio hour is why the argument between Hillary's resume and Bernie's doctrine feels a little unreal, maybe phony, awkward, even before the protester from Black Lives Matter crashed the Hillary Clinton party this week. Our lead-off guest, Brian Stevenson, has won a big following with a bold answer to the question. He says the race conversation in America is cracked at the foundation by the living legacy of slavery, by the popular narrative of race and racial difference that we Americans peculiarly have never buried. Trial lawyer and activist based in Montgomery, Alabama, Brian Stevenson jumped over the ruts in the race conversation in a TED Talk 4 years ago. Nearly 3 million people have seen it now. We engaged him this week by phone in Seattle.
Well, I think that we are not free in America. And for me, this is about us moving forward, us taking a step closer to something that feels like liberation, that feels like freedom. We are not free. We are haunted by our history of racial inequality. We are a post-genocidal society without having acknowledged the genocide, what happened to indigenous people in this country, the plight of Native Americans when white settlers came, has cast a pall, a shadow over what happens in America. And we haven't talked about it, so we're not really free from all of the taint of that era. The contemporary problem for me is that we are still burdened by a narrative of racial difference that undermines our ability to be free and just. And we have to really reimagine what it means to attack that. And for me, that means talking about slavery. It means talking about lynching and the racial terrorism that shaped that era. It means talking differently about segregation and the era of civil rights. It means talking about the presumption of dangerousness and guilt that follows black and brown people today and that has given rise to over-incarceration and huge disparities and racial bias. It means talking about all of those issues in a new and different way.
Brian, some of us are realizing almost for the first time that we never remade the founding documents of our society, as South Africa did in the modern time. They wrote, "We, the people of South Africa, recognize the injustices of our past," in the preamble of their new constitution. I mean, why didn't we do that? Or could we imagine doing that ourselves?
Yeah, I think we have to. I mean, you come to a place like Montgomery, and you'll find 59 markers and monuments to the Confederacy. In the state of Alabama, Confederate Memorial Day is a state holiday. Jefferson Davis's birthday is a state holiday. We don't even have Martin Luther King Day. It's Martin Luther King / Robert E. Lee Day. And we are doing that because we've never really been willing to acknowledge the shame and the horror of American slavery. We are actually trying to create a narrative that celebrates the architects and defenders of slavery because we are unwilling to engage in that truthful dialogue. And so I do think we have to reframe. The great evil of American slavery for me was not involuntary servitude or forced labor. I think the great evil of American slavery was the narrative of racial difference that we created to legitimate it. It was the ideology of white supremacy that we made up to make ourselves feel comfortable with slavery. And if you read the 13th Amendment, it doesn't deal with the narrative of racial difference. It doesn't deal with the ideology of white supremacy. It deals with involuntary servitude and forced labor. And because of that, I don't think slavery ended in 1865. I think it just evolved. It turned into decades of terrorism and violence and the tragedy of Reconstruction, where white supremacists reclaimed the South and resurrected this romantic, idealized interpretation of the Confederacy still prevails. And then what we saw was violence. We saw thousands of African Americans murdered and burned to death and mutilated. The demographic geography of this nation was shaped by racial terrorism. The black people in Cleveland and Chicago and Detroit and Los Angeles and Oakland, they went to those communities as refugees and exiles from terror.
You know, when you speak of refugees from Jim Crow, suddenly I think of Hungarians that came to this country in the 50s, Cubans that have come over the period of the Castro regime. And we sort of bought it. These are refugees, but never thought of Bill Russell, for example, a great Boston star, whose family fled Monroe, Louisiana, in much greater danger. How do we wake up to that sort of obvious point?
Well, I think we have to understand why it is that we do not see the victimization of these people in the same way. We have to understand that if you don't fully recognize the humanity of people of color, of African Americans, if you don't see them as fully human, if you don't see their suffering and their struggle the same way you value the suffering and struggle of Europeans or even Cubans, then you're not going to be prepared to deal appropriately, responsibly, humanely with that community. And if we allowed for decades black men and women and children to be pulled out of jail cells and burned to death in front of crowds, not of Klan members, not of people with masks, but in crowds that included judges and lawyers and teachers and clergy and bankers, if you allow that, if you're comfortable with that, then you're not going to receive these refugees, these exiles from terror, the way that we have in other communities. And what we did was we merely tolerated these black refugees in Chicago and Boston, and Cleveland and Los Angeles and Oakland, and we moved them around when it became necessary for us in these communities for economic development. And that's how the urban ghetto was created. It was created because we were never prepared to meet the legitimate needs of these Americans who had been traumatized and forced out of the American South because of our indifference to racial justice.
Can I ask, I wonder why Flint, Michigan wasn't the perfect teaching moment for exactly these points. Simply that a majority black and poor city in our country can be served another color of public water and be told to accept it, as nobody else would be.
Yeah, I think, though, it's just one more example of this larger phenomenon. You have communities all over the country where environmental waste is being dumped and toxic sites are being created because they are closer to poor black communities than they are to other communities that would never accept them. You have this trauma taking place in zip codes. There are 200 zip codes in this nation that we can identify where 50-60% of the children are going to end up in jails or prisons or in some acute stress because they are born into families that are violent. They're living in violent neighborhoods. They're going to violent schools. And the plight of these children doesn't cause us to intervene. That's the heritage, if you will, of white supremacy, of tolerating the genocide of Native people, tolerating enslavement, demonizing Mexicans and Central Americans during this immigration debate in this racialized way, profiling Muslims and Arabs because we have some idea that all Muslims and Arabs are dangerous. It is part of our historic national DNA, and until we treat it, until we cure it by committing ourselves, we are still going to be infected with this disease. And the only way you can cure it, Chris, is by doing what other nations have done. You go to Germany, and you can't go 100 meters in Berlin, Germany, without seeing a marker or stone that's been placed near the family of a home of a family of Jewish people that were abducted during the Holocaust. And that's why our project is really deeply committed. We want to put a marker at every lynching site in America. I don't think you should be able to come to Montgomery without being reminded of the domestic slave trade, or Richmond, or Columbus, or Savannah, Charleston, or New Orleans.
I just wonder, as you speak about it, what's wrong with us? We're a smart country. We have a huge place in the world, and we love it. But we're hobbling ourselves. How would we get over it?
Well, I think we have to create an awareness that you're not healthy if you don't experience shame when you do things that are wrong. We think expressing shame, expressing failure, is a sign of weakness. I think a mature society ultimately learns that it's a sign of strength. You show me two people who have loved one another in a committed relationship for 30 or 40 years, and I'll show you two people who've learned how to say, I'm sorry, to one another, who've learned how to manage their shortcomings, their failings, in a way that accommodates articulation of shame and remorse. We haven't done that.
You know, you began by saying we're not free. We're an unliberated people in certain ways. Think of South Carolina. The whole dialogue of politics gets different in the South, where We have a woman with a long resume and a man with a sort of comprehensive doctrine of reform, both trying to tailor their appeal to black people, white people too. But we know there's something stilted, awkward, difficult about the whole conversation. Can you decode that in the terms you're talking about?
Well, yeah, I think race is a tool in America. We use it as a means to some other end. Everybody understands it's this gaping wound in the body politic, in the soul of this nation. But rarely are people willing to stop and address the injury, to treat it. We can't fundamentally treat this injury, treat this disease in the course of a presidential election. That's not the forum for managing this larger issue. We have to step back from elected politics and begin to recognize that the conversation is different because the challenges are so overwhelming. They're so apparent in places like South Carolina, where not that long ago, a young white man went into a church and slaughtered 9 black people while they were praying because he was so corrupted by this ideology of white supremacy that with the guns he can get anywhere, he could actually act on it. And there was a moment of shame in South Carolina, which I think was really interesting, where that state decided to step back from some of that iconography. They pulled the Confederate flag down. It was a moment of shame, and it needs to be an era of shame where we begin to revisit these histories and create a new landscape that makes it less volatile when presidential candidates 40 years from now are campaigning in South Carolina. But I think we have to acknowledge that this is an American problem that requires not just our officials, but all of us, clergy, teachers, local leaders, all of us are implicated in this.
Brian Stevenson got his law degree at Harvard and his genius designation from the MacArthur Foundation. Coming up with yet another MacArthur genius, the historian Barbara Fields, how racism, which is real, invented race, which is a myth, and racecraft, the game in our heads. This is Open Source. Race and racism. A work in progress in South Carolina this weekend, in a rising public conversation too. The changing same in America was the late Amiri Baraka's phrase, but it's very much in motion nowadays. Jacqueline Rivers joins us, a civilian authority we love, with roots in Dorchester and Jamaica before that, a life in teaching and mothering, and now grown-up graduate study on her own at Harvard. Bill Fletcher, Jr. is with us on the line from New York, union man, radio host, writer. Jackie, you first. Talk back to that voice of Brian Stevenson. Rings pretty true and brave to me.
Well, I think he has a powerful point. What we saw after the Civil War was really an inversion of shame, that it was black people who were supposed to be ashamed because the South rejected that there was anything wrong with slavery or that they were in any way responsible for wrongdoing. And in fact, the importance of white unity really took precedence over justice. And so the North rushed to embrace the South. Now, what I think is important about the history that Brian Stevenson is tracing is that it continues right up into the 20th and even the 21st century. So it's really important. I mean, if you look at the work of Ira Katz Nelson, it's not just about what happened during Reconstruction or in the decades after, but even under FDR, under Roosevelt, when you're looking at what happens with the implementation of the New Deal, the way in which blacks were left out of the New Deal quite deliberately as agricultural workers and as domestics, the way it was implemented in the South by locals who denied blacks their rights. Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about the same thing happening in Chicago around housing when blacks arrive in the North and again they're victimized. So it's really important. I think Stevenson is right. America is not going to get to the root of this until it stops denying the wrong that was done. Let me say one other thing, Chris, and that is this: here we are 8 years after the beginning of the post-racial era, except it isn't post-racial at all. It isn't post-racial at all. But people in this country, Americans were quick to try to cover over the reality of racial injustice and proclaim that because now there was a black president, we were post-racial.
I never bought that. I never understood what they were talking about, I have to tell you.
Another whole story. Right.
Bill Fletcher, Jr., welcome to Open Source. That strong stuff that Brian Stevens is introducing, we are a post-genocidal society. Your reaction, please.
Well, I'm glad to be on the program, and I haven't seen Jackie in about 25 years.
Hi, Bill.
So happy to be on the same program. It is strong stuff. I mean, the only thing that I would probably differ with Brian is that he is placing the issue of racism and white supremacy more at the ideological level. And I think that it's impossible to understand, let alone correct, the problems of this country unless you understand that it's systemic. It's not simply ideological. It's not just the propagation of white superiority as an idea. It's the construction of a racial differential in treatment in every feature of society. And that's what we live with. And so when we talk about denial, we're not only denying genocide that's happened against African Americans, but also other peoples, particularly Native Americans, but we're also in this denial of the existence of the racial differential. And that is why you have people that say that programs like affirmative action are wrong, because they say that it's allegedly giving something to people that didn't earn it. What they're saying, in effect, is no, I cannot see the racial differential. I cannot see the way that race has been structured into the society. So I think that that's the only thing that I would amend to what Brian offered.
We'll get further into that matter of the construction of racial differences. It's crucial. But there are so many other things. The major points almost prove themselves. For example, for me, I was very just touched by his speaking of blacks from Jim Crow in Boston and elsewhere, the makers of our modern culture, were not migrants. They were refugees, much more acutely than the Cubans that we honor, or Eastern Europeans coming out of communism, etc. These things, once they're said clearly, are unmistakably, to my mind, true. The question still, though, is could we undergo an era of shame? He says it could go 40 years, even if we knew our lives depended on it, the life of the Republic required it. That's a huge challenge. Jackie.
Yes, and I think that that's one that it boggles the imagination. If when it was so much more demonstrably true coming right out of slavery, and when it really was more clearly a racial difference between blacks and whites, right. If it was denied then, now that it is so much more complicated, It seems extremely difficult to see how we will get to the era of shame he's talking about. But America does have to confront this.
Note also, as in the German parallel, the military defeat was complete. We'd lost 700,000 Americans in the Civil War over that folly, more than we lost in World War II.
Indeed.
And that didn't bring us to the brink of aha.
No, instead it was papered over very swiftly. And the Northerners were more interested in reconciling with their Southern brothers and sisters than in standing up for justice for the people whom, to some extent, the war was fought.
Bill Fletcher, Brian Stevenson wants to rename or deal with 59 monuments to the Confederacy in Montgomery, Alabama, one city. Can you imagine walking around New York and designating, or Boston, or the Harvard campus, for that matter, Yale campus, and renaming places for their forgotten victims?
Well, I think that that's part of what needs to actually happen. But I don't think that the idea of an era of shame is actually really useful. I think an era of rediscovery, however, mm-hmm. is. That is that we need to engage in a broad-based reexamination of the history of the United States. And when we do that, we will find that it is incredibly complex, very bloody, real high moments and terrible moments. We'll find that this construction of race was done with the clear objective of not only suppressing a population, but instituting a mechanism of social control over all those that work. When you do that through an examination, a reexamination, a rediscovery, I think it then becomes exciting and actually can become a political project. Because the thing that we do not need is the idea of white people feeling bad about themselves. Mm-hmm. This is not a moral crusade in that sense. This needs to be a political project that helps us to understand why race was constructed. And one of the things I just want to differ slightly with Jackie. The defeat of Reconstruction in the 1870s was largely the result of a political deal that was arrived at when Northern industrial capital realized that it had successfully subordinated the Southern plantation class, and that the Southern plantation class was prepared to operate within the constraints that Northern capital had set. They were willing to go with the program, in other words. And on that basis, federal troops were pulled out of the South, and the Reconstruction was not only abandoned, it was overthrown. It was a counter-revolution, a point that W.E.B. Du Bois made so graphically and some ways poetically in his famous book, Black Reconstruction in America. And I think that's part of the rediscovery, re-understanding what happened in Reconstruction.
So, Bill, I would say that I wouldn't disagree with the very strong economic motives, but I think it's really important to also confront the shared ideology, because ideology is part of what drives this. It's not merely economics.
We got to talk about a political project that's playing out and being talked out as we speak in the South Carolina presidential primary between Hillary Clinton, of course, and Bernie Sanders. I wish you'd both listen to two black men that we cherish talk their own Hillary and Bernie choices. Up first is Calvin McCreevan. He's a technologist in Birmingham with close family ties in Boston. His Hillary vote is to honor the Obama record and the whole idea of continuity.
It's a time where one group of people say this isn't working, and another group of people say, look at how far we've come. Since the Civil Rights Movement, I see that there's been a great deal of growth and development. My mother loves to say that black people, and I think she would mean poor people, women, gay people as well, have made more progress since the Civil Rights Movement began than anybody has ever made throughout history. And I think that that is very, very, very accurate. So I see a real issue with progressive outsiders like Mr. Sanders not really understanding what work has been done. What I want to get done is to maintain the stability which the president has allowed us to have over these last 7 years, right? And to concretize his accomplishments, the accomplishments of those Democratic presidencies before him, and for her, Hillary, to add to that legacy. Because this is not about Hillary's legacy or Barack's legacy. This is about the legacy of activism within the political process over the last 50 years. Unfortunately, many people under the age of 50 are not aware of that.
There's barely an argument in the Democratic side about some very important issues and differences in, say, criminal justice or housing or the costs of education. Throw one of them into a debate between Bernie and Hillary that would bring out something of real interest to you, Calvin.
I would really like to hear Mr. Sanders and Ms. Clinton discuss the meaning of racial, gender, sexual orientation, identity in this pluralistic environment that we know as the United States. When I hear Hillary talk, I hear a person who is not a black person, who doesn't understand Black culture totally, but who is willing to learn and will be shaped by those who do. Hmm. When I hear Bernie Sanders, I see an individual who wants to look at Black people as part of a greater proletariat, right, that are beyond race and things of that nature, and it is purely an economic argument. Hmm. And this is where he makes his mistake. I would like to see Mr. Sanders talk about what it means to be a Jew in America. I would like to hear Hillary Clinton talk about what it means to be a woman in America. For Black people, ethnic identity is with them everywhere they go. You can see me coming a mile away. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I love it. Nevertheless, it is a part of my reality. Mr. Sanders denies that.
That was my friend Calvin McCreevin in Birmingham, Alabama. Michael Denzel Smith, out of a Navy family from Virginia, emerging now as a writer in New York, is minimally for Bernie.
I believe in voting in terms of one political tool. Hold your nose, vote for the lesser of two evils, and then get to the work of what democracy looks like in that you are protesting, you are organizing, you are writing, you are doing political education within communities, you are forming power blocks that you know, politicians have to respond to, because that's really what it is. It's about consciousness raising. It's about putting ideas forth that aren't in the mainstream now, but like building the support and introducing them to people, making them make sense to people so that we do think through these things in a different way. I mean, neither Bernie Sanders nor Hillary Clinton are debating on the merits of like a universal basic income or a job guarantee or land value tax. Like these are not things that are within the current stream, but these are things that you can demand from politicians.
Michael, what I'm hearing is a kind of Black Lives Matter music trying to find some sort of counterpoint or harmony or tension or something with this campaign conversation. Can the two be heard in one summer and fall?
Well, I mean, particularly in this moment in which we're talking a lot more about violent policing, we're talking about police brutality, we're talking about the deaths of unarmed Black people, we're talking about the ways in which to reform police and improve community relations. My question would be, in the way to sort of shift that, would be to ask the question, how would you solve the problems of that police are supposed to be solving without the police, right? Mm-hmm. Like the police supposedly are supposed to keep communities safe. They're supposed to protect you from violence, interpersonal violence, from, you know, murders and assaults and rapes and things of this nature. How would you solve all of those problems if you did not have the police at your disposal? And I think that that's when you start getting to a conversation about a robust investment in social welfare, and you're talking about education, and you're talking about alleviating poverty, because so much of the violence that we're afraid of is connected to poverty. It's connected to dilapidated housing. It's connected to a lack of resources and a lack of recreation. That's when we start solving a problem, as opposed to bandaging over it with things like, you know, body cameras and community review boards and like appointing special prosecutors. I mean, those are things that you do in the interim so that there's some sense of accountability here, but those are not things that get at the root.
Jackie Rivers, my friend Calvin was saying, stay the course. Poor people need stability more than revolution. Michael Denzel Smith was just saying the real work of politics now is changing the conversation. Place yourself between Hillary and the burn.
So I'm glad that Bernie's pushing Hillary to talk about some of these issues, he's pushing her to the left. What I really want to know is who's going to deliver for Black people. And that, I think that makes me lean towards Hillary. She seems more practical. She recognizes that what we need before we need college is we need people to succeed in K-12 education. She recognizes that in addition to the problem of police violence, we have young men who are shooting each other in the streets.
I want to give Bill Fletcher a chance. How invested are you either in Bernie or Hillary, Bill?
I'm a supporter of Sanders, but I'm a critical supporter.
How so?
Well, I feel that what Sanders is saying that's so important is that the game is rigged. The system is rigged. It's rigged against working people. It's rigged against people at the bottom. There is this tremendous accumulation of wealth at the top, and it's getting worse and worse. And he's absolutely right about that. The problem, it relates to something that one of the individuals you interviewed picked up on, which is that Sanders has much more difficulty, for whatever reason, integrating the discussion of race into this overall narrative. So you hear a narrative that's very important, but it feels like part of a story, but not the entirety of the story.
Could you coach him in 30 seconds in, I don't know, getting more comfortable with black people?
I don't think it's about coaching him. I think it's about the campaign changing strategy.
Meaning?
The campaign as a whole needs to be bringing in leaders from the communities of color and listening to them, and that will help in the reshaping of a strategy that I think could actually win.
Stand by, Bill Fletcher. We're talking about race. Coming up, racecraft, by which Barbara Fields means the mental landscape of artificial distinctions. This is Open Source. South Carolina primary weekend is our cue to talk the color line in politics. Barbara Fields is an esteemed historian of the South, where she was born, at Columbia University in New York. She fights racism by denying race categorically. The problem that has taken this country to the precipice, she told us this week, is inequality. She says racism is the evil code of group privilege and invented differences. Race is nonsense, basic nonsense. Race craft is a process of self-deception.
There's no race story in this campaign. There is a racism story, and there's an inequality story, and the two are connected. Racism and inequality have the same central nervous system. They're part of the same process. People cannot think, for example, that Bernie Sanders is addressing problems of black people unless he has a black label on it with a bow tied around it saying this is for black people. But when he says minimum wage, higher education within everybody's reach, you know, that sort of thing, these are the inequality problems that are plaguing everybody, and they're one of the reasons why racism, not race, racism is intense and resurgent in this country, because we have a white working population that by and large expected to be taken care of, to be treated fairly as long as they abided by the rules. And they have felt let down with good reason. Not just over the years since the crash, but in general in the years probably going back as far as the 1970s, but certainly from the 80s, they're watching their situation deteriorate. It's been true also for black working people, and if anything, to a more intense degree, the difference is that black people never expected fairness. And so they don't react to unfairness in the same way. You know, you don't see them going after Donald Trump. It's not the lashing out or the looking for a scapegoat that is what you have when you have removed the possibility of a serious politics to address grievances coming out of inequality, such as we have where white people are concerned. They don't have a language for talking about why they are angry and why they feel aggrieved, except a language of racism or a language of let's go after the Muslims or immigrants have taken away our this, that, and the other. And that's because they can't frame it in terms of a class grievance to do with inequality, because we don't have that language available. And for me, it's heartening that Bernie Sanders is speaking that language, and it does seem that there are white working people listening to it and responding to it, because they haven't heard anybody else taking seriously the deterioration that they notice in their own circumstances. To me, that is a favorable thing for black and white people.
Since the death of Trayvon Martin, Ferguson, Staten Island, Charleston, the University of Missouri football team, Flint, Michigan, there has been evolving not only news, but a kind of serious reflection, Ta-Nehisi Coates, maybe most famously, on some underlying racial reality that we just haven't dealt with. How does that, how should that intersect with our presidential campaign?
Well, I've told you that I don't believe in race. That's a meaningless category to me. I said this to my students apropos of Flint, Michigan. I said, racecraft has disappeared 44% of the population of Flint because majority black, easily transmuted into black in the public media, so now people think of Flint as a black city. That means that 44% of its population has been disappeared. Those people are part and parcel of the same story about an unsafe water supply and infrastructure there that ignored Legionnaires' disease, it ignored lead in the water, it ignored the need to provide what in a civilized society is basic infrastructure for all of its people. That became very quickly, though, a racecraft matter, because it turned into something racial. Well, what does it mean to say it's racial? You know that Flint is not an all-black city. But in the eyes, I would say, of most of the public that reads the newspapers, that's probably how it looks, because it's the only way they can account for that kind of callousness toward human beings living in that place.
And how do you account for it, Professor Fields?
I account for it by saying that we left democracy behind a long time ago, and that class inequality has become something so taken for granted that we don't even think it merits another look. We make international trade agreements without any regard to what's going to happen to American people, American working people, when the global corporations are in charge of things and are only looking after their bottom line. Nobody has to care what happens to automobile workers when global corporations decide that in the cutting up of this pie, we're just going to take these jobs away. And if they are white people's jobs, they disappear, and many of those white people say they disappeared because of affirmative action. If they are black people's jobs that disappear, then people looking on, not black people, but other people looking on, may think, well, you know how those people are. They probably don't show up to work, or they are probably drug addicts, or this, that, and the other. And when we start to see large numbers of white people dying of drug overdoses, that's amazing. It's an anomaly.
Yeah.
You know, we have to have special news articles to deal with that. It's not as though we haven't seen this happen in the past. We've seen drug epidemics in the past. But we've decided that those are a matter of race, not of racism. So when it happened to black people, it's because it was their nature. Now the drug overdose epidemics aren't happening among black people. Now it has moved to other communities, and the news articles will say, well, what's wrong with white, what's happened to white people? Because it won't be interpreted as something wrong with them, but it will be something special has happened to them. Well, excuse me, the same thing has happened that's been happening in this country to anybody who happens to be at that level of our society. So anybody could have said if this has happened to black people living in inner cities, it's because they're at the leading edge of a phenomenon that is across the board. Well, now we're seeing it across the board, and people are still looking, well, what's happening to white people? You know exactly what's happening to them, because this is what happens to working people, and we've seen it again and again.
That was Professor Barbara Fields at Columbia University, a MacArthur winner. Bill Fletcher, Jr. in New York, Jackie Rivers in Boston. Barbara Fields says, talk about families, working class interests, communities. Race, she says, is a non-category. You were just saying it's a construction, Bill. Define it.
So what I would agree with Professor Fields is that there is something very real called class oppression in the United States, and that workers are, in fact, exploited and oppressed by those at the top. That's absolutely the case. The issue in saying that race doesn't exist but that there is racism, you know, it gets a little complicated. Race does not exist as a scientific category. There's only one race on this planet, and that's the human race, and it originated in southern Africa. So in that sense, as someone once said, we're all Africans. But but race as a political category very much does exist. And when she's talking about Flint, Michigan, one of the things that I think we have to understand is to borrow from that great that statement, those who the gods would destroy, they first drive mad. In the United States, those who the gods will destroy, they first make brown and black. In order to advance projects that are aimed at squelching democracy or increasing the pressure on those who work, you brown or blacken the target, and that makes it much easier for those who are wealthy and powerful to move against them. And that's what you can see in places like Flint and other such places. When those cities are described, or when they are majority black or brown or described as such, it's much easier for the rest of society to write them off. And that's what I would agree with the professor.
She also says
that means it doesn't exist.
She wouldn't say those categories don't exist. She would say, and she says it passionately, that the splitting up of demographics into tiny slices, like they were a music market or something. Every generation is different. Every age group, every variety of work or ethnicity or religious belief is a different category, is a kind of almost conscious program to make us forget not just that we're all one together, but that we're suffering from a common neurosis, a common bad economy, a common troubled future, sort of an existential problem as Americans in the 21st century. I find that sort of persuasive.
Almost conscious. It is conscious. But it goes back to something that Jackie was saying about the importance of ideology. You can't just simply ignore it. I mean, yes, it is a conscious effort to divide people up. There's no question about that. But you've got to deal with the fact that there are huge numbers of people that have adopted certain identities despite the fact that there's no scientific basis for such an identity.
And I want to, I certainly want to agree with you on that, Bill, and with Professor Fields, that there is no scientific basis for this idea of race. But I also want to agree with Bill that it is a very real political and social reality. So, you know, Professor Fields points to the fact that the anger that's abroad in the country is sort of like the underbelly of the new Gilded Age. And so it's driving voters on one hand to Sanders and the other hand to Donald Trump. Don't tell me there isn't a racial divide there, that there's an openness to racial discrimination among the supporters of Trump that you don't find among the supporters of Sanders. So what it looks as though, you know, on my optimistic day, that perhaps there is a revolution brewing? Perhaps there's some exciting change afoot. The fact that that people are standing up and building on perhaps this notion of the 1%, that the 99%, maybe not just the poor, but the middle class too, would get involved and really change and upend the system. But it doesn't get rid of the problem of racism, because that differentiates the experience of Black people no matter what their socioeconomic status.
But how's this for irony? Bernie Sanders wants people to feel united in a common struggle as workers. Workers unite, in effect.
Yes.
But our friend Calvin McCreevan, as an anti-racist Black man, doesn't want to be undifferentiated proletarian. You know, he wants to be embraced.
Wants to be seen black.
Yeah,
wants
exactly.
To be seen coming.
He's not tribal, but he wants that ethnic difference to be recognized.
And that simply reflects the experience of sociologists who all declared that race was going, well, not all, but Alba in particular, Richard Alba, declared that, you know, race and ethnicity were simply going to be washed out into the melting pot. It hasn't happened. People hold on to their ethnicity and to their race. It's part of our need to have an identity.
I got to throw in one general question. What allowance do we make for the nonstop celebration of racial, of Black and racially tinged expression in our pop culture? Rap is the sound of this era. And moreover, young people today are demonstrably much more at ease in their minds and in their behavior across the color difference. Bill, do you have a thought on that? I mean, is that redeeming?
Part of it is the result of successful struggles. You can't look at this in the absence of understanding the struggles of the Black Freedom Movement, of the Chicano Movement, the Puerto Rican Movement, et cetera, that started to break down many of these barriers. So that's part of the, I would say, part of the victories. But the victories were set back in the 1970s and moving forward. And so you'll see these bright spots. And I think that what you also, one recognizes, is that in African-American culture, you have a culture of rebellion. You have a culture that rebels against injustice. And other people unite with that, not just in the United States, but you see it all around the world. It's not just that there's this hypnotic aspect of Black culture, African-American culture. It's grows out of this deep resentment of injustice. And so that has an impact on other sectors.
Can I throw out a last question and an observation? The new race conversation, the Bryan Stevenson brief, in short, sounds to me more real, more vital than anything in this presidential campaign, but I wonder that it hasn't penetrated to the political discourse. Jackie.
So I think that comes back to the resistance to recognizing, to challenging the American ideology of American exceptionalism, that Americans are the righteous people, the good people, and to confront the realities that Bryan Stevenson is talking about is to challenge that. I want to say one other thing about hip-hop, that it comes out of the same kind of perhaps a related anger, the anger of oppression. That's where it really started. Question is it now really a positive force? Is it something that actually works against inequality and oppression any longer?
Bryan Stevenson's line was that we have a whole songbook of self-celebration in America, but also that it's leading us over the cliff. We're deluded. It's dangerous. It could destroy us. Bill?
We're at a critical moment in the history of this country where, and it goes back to something that was being raised much earlier in the conversation, where the resentment, the growing resentment among whites who are feeling betrayed is not finding a political expression. And hopefully the Sanders campaign is part of that, but it will only succeed if it engages in the kind of historical reexamination that Brian, Jackie, and I are trying to advance.
Bill, I gotta let it go there. Thank you for joining us, Bill Fletcher in New York, Jackie Rivers in Boston. Thanks also to Brian Stevenson, Barbara Fields, Calvin McCreevan, and Michael Smith. There is a timeline of the past 4 years of tumult and fresh inquiry along the color line on our website, radioopensource.org. This week's show was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, and Abby Duker. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.